The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Given everything we've seen, given the, you know, the conflicting agendas within the Trump administration, there are some people who just want to agree a quick deal and have all of this trade stuff go away. There are others who are much more hawkish and say, no, there are these really fundamental issues. China's industrial policy, we really need them to have this wholesale change in their economic strategy before we'll agree anything. Right. So it's that second group that if they win, we could go all the way. We could get these tariffs. They've really been trying to keep these issues separate. They've been claiming that this is a trade issue and that, you know, that's the other stuff. But I'm not sure geopolitics works like that. If you are in a situation where you've got $50, $100, $150 billion worth of trade affected by tariffs, I think it could make things pretty difficult.
I'm Shannon Tagawa Mercer, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 9th, 2018. Economic welfare and national security have never been mutually exclusive, but trade is factored into the national security discourse prominently in recent days. With the administration announcing tariffs on steel and aluminum imports in the name of national security, the backlash from American allies, and the current standoff with China, it was about time to discuss trade on the Lawfare podcast. On Thursday, June 7th, I sat down with Dr. Megan Rees, Senior National Security Fellow at the R Street Institute and Senior Editor at Lawfare, and Soumaya Keynes, Economics and Trade Correspondent at The Economist, to discuss the ins and outs of trade law and how Trump is using it. We talked about Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act, steel and aluminum imports, or aluminium, as one of our panelists insists it's pronounced, and the World Trade Organization, among many other topics. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 319, Soumaya Keynes and Dr. Megan Rees on trade and national security under the Trump administration. We're doing something a little different today at Lawfare. We don't often talk about trade, but as many of our listeners know, trade and national security are inextricably linked, especially in recent events. So we're going to dive directly into trade law here on the Lawfare Podcast and explore the domestic and international consequences of the U.S. trade actions. So first, I think there's one very clear and explicit connection between national security and trade implicated over the last couple months, and that is Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act. Megan, can you explain to us what is Section 232?
So Section 232 is the provision that allows designating a specific imports as a national security threat. And it's really, really significant because it means that our actual national security is at risk if trade continues in the way that it's going now. And so what happened is the president ended up designating steel after a review process as a steel imports as a national security threat to the fundamental security of the United States. Huge deal. And so it's going to be really fun to talk about what that means today on this podcast.
Sure. Can you tell us a little bit more about that designation? So it sounds like there was a process under Section 232. What did that look like? What was the investigation like?
Yes. So the process was the Commerce Department ended up reviewing whether steel imports would be a significant barrier to the needs of the Defense Department in particular. It was signed off on by Secretary Mattis, which was honestly a little surprising to some folks. And it allowed us to put large restrictions on the import of steel in particular. And the review process, of course, was necessary in order to get to the president's authorization, although the administration themselves are the folks who initiated the review process.
So the Department of Commerce, as I understand it, conducted the review process, and Wilbur Ross, the secretary, has been quite vocal about the intention and the trajectory of 232 tariffs. Sumaya, could you tell us a little bit about what that looked like from your perspective?
Yeah, so historically, this is a law that has been used to essentially connect imports with, you know, hostile foreign actors, right? And so, you know, the intuition behind it is, well, you might say that America might need a particular product and might be overly reliant on some hostile nation for it. And therefore, the president has the authority to essentially, you know, restrict trade in some way to you know, correct that problem. So in the case of steel and also aluminium, the Commerce Department investigated essentially the impact of imports on those two industries. And, you know, normally you might think that things like oil or, you know, parts that are used in making military equipment, you know, you might be too reliant on those from some kind of hostile actor. In this case, you know, the Department of Defense released, I think, a letter or a memo or something saying that they only required 3% of U.S. Mm-hmm. steel output, right? And so it doesn't seem like the U.S. Department of Defense is overly reliant on, you know, imports at all from anyone. And so what the argument that they had to make, that the Commerce Department was making, was that essentially these imports were they were threatening America's kind of economic security. These were critical industries like, you know, construction. America's infrastructure depended on these imports, and that was dangerous. Reading the report, there were some really, you know, fun nuggets in mm-hmm. there. So they essentially made a connection between the kind of mobilization that the U.S. made after the Second World War and also during the Vietnam War. And they said, oh, look, you know, America had to massively scale up its production. And if something like that happened today, we would struggle to do it on a very short time frame. You know, I think a lot of people had furrowed brows when this mm-hmm. came out, because, you know, the connection between now and the Vietnam War, which, you know, the mobilization happened over a very long time, you know, modern warfare wouldn't really have the same requirements. It was a bit odd, essentially.
Yeah. And just to cut in 2001, President Bush actually initiated a 232 review process for steel in particular. Mm-hmm. And this was, of course, at a time when we did think mobilization was necessary because of the start of the Afghanistan war. Well, they actually decided to move away from they declined to impose restrictions under the 232 designation under this context at a time when we really were ramping up. And now we're multiple mm-hmm. 17, 18 years into these wars, and it's not quite there.
So what you're saying is there are reasons to think that this is less plausible than it would have been then mm-hmm. amongst the other economic arguments.
So there's been a lot of focus on steel, and I mm-hmm. think there it's much harder to make the case that there is a national security threat there, that mm-hmm. America is overly reliant on hostile countries. I mean, there's the basic fact that actually America imports a lot of its steel from places like the European Union, mm-hmm. Canada, Mexico, not, you know, countries thought of or governments thought of as hostile to America.
Sure.
It's actually easier to make the national security case if you move to aluminium, right, which is the other product mm-hmm. that there's been this investigation into. So there are certain kinds of high purity aluminium that is used to make essentially American military aircraft, and essentially capacity to make that within the U.S. has gone down. There's one smelter left in the U.S., in Hallsville, Kentucky, mm-hmm. run by Century mm-hmm. Aluminium Company. I actually went there, got my hard hat and my boots on. It was
That's
great
excellent.
Fun. So there is this one smelter left that can make this kind of high purity aluminium. And so you can make the case there that, oh, you know, we are that the American military is somehow reliant on this smelting capacity being there. And also the aluminium companies would say that in order to produce this high purity stuff, you need to be able to produce the more general stuff at high volumes. You don't only need to consider that high purity aluminium, you need to, the rest of the industry needs to be healthy, essentially. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there are a couple of problems with that. One, again, the US imports a lot of its aluminium from Canada, not seen as a hostile country. The other thing is that in order to smelt aluminium, you need inputs, right? You need bauxite, alumina. America doesn't have those, right? So it kind of is weird to say, oh, we're overly reliant on imports of, you know, this aluminium product when you don't have the raw materials that you need to make that, right? So there's a kind of underlying issue which makes this whole thing a bit strange. It's almost like the Trump administration decided that they wanted to protect the aluminium and steel industries for non-national security reasons, and they were using this law as a way to get them there.
Almost like that.
A little bit.
So there are the arguments on their face, and then there's the timelines or the story behind how these particular 232 tariffs were rolled out. So if we look at them over time, they were announced, and then there was a sort of pause, right, an opportunity for exemptions, and then different countries were treated differently. So Sumaya, could you tell us a little bit about how that looked over time?
Yeah, so when the Commerce Department came out with its report, its recommendations for, you know, what they said that the president should do, there were these three options, right? So the first option was that they would hit everyone with a tariff. The second was that they would hit everyone with a quota. And the third option was that they would have this combo deal, right? And that some countries would get tougher treatment in terms of this higher tariff, and other countries would be let off the hook, and they would have a quota. So what happened was, in March, the Trump administration essentially implemented the first round of tariffs on some countries and let other countries completely off the hook. But the connection between that report's recommendations and the countries that he actually imposed tariffs on, there wasn't a very tight connection. So the original report said maybe you want higher tariffs on places like China or Brazil. And then in March, when these things were actually rolled out, countries like Japan, they were hit by the tariffs. And also countries, I think, like Brazil got excluded from the tariff. Mm-hmm. They essentially extended the deadline a bit to see if they could negotiate some kind of deal.
Mm-hmm. And then our biggest steel importers, right, Canada and the EU, were given an opportunity to negotiate a new deal.
Exactly. So what the Trump administration said, they didn't say, oh, we have concluded that imports from Canada, Mexico, and the EU are not a national security threat. They essentially said, okay, well, we're going to put these tariffs on these other countries, but why don't you give us the opportunity to prove to us that you're not a national security threat? So they gave them some time to negotiate some kind of deal.
And that came to a head recently, didn't it? The third deadline in this extended saga was last Friday, and the United States announced that it would levy tariffs against Canada and the EU, which came on the right before the finance minister's G7 conference. And so that was the perfect opportunity for all of our allies to voice their concerns about what seems like a hostile trade policy.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were very surprised. I think in the weeks coming up to this, I think it was increasingly clear that the European Union, you know, they were going to be hit by these tariffs, and they were very well prepared for that. And, you know, the Canadians and the Mexicans were prepared as well. They had lists ready of products that they would hit back with. But, you know, it was so surprising because essentially the Trump administration has just been receiving a huge amount of lobbying from folks who were saying, please don't hit Canada. It's not only the fact that they're our allies, we actually produce stuff together. They're integrated supply chains. You know, the union for steel workers is the same union between Canada and the US, right? This is an integrated economic area in more ways than one. It really didn't make sense on an economic basis, let alone the national security basis.
Yeah, so I'm curious about the national security implications of that, right? Clearly, it's a bad economic situation to be in, but what does this mean for our relationship with Canada and Mexico?
I mean, it means so many things. You have Trudeau talking to President Trump recently about literally asking him, how are you justifying this under a national security threat justification? We are not a threat to you. And of course, Trump hits back joking about the War of 1812 with the British. So, you know, he didn't have the firmest response.
I'm sure that was a tough thing for you to swallow, Sumaya.
I have to let some things wash over me. That was one of them. Yeah.
But this is also coming at a time where the U.S. is actually experiencing some really difficult national security situations abroad. Mm-hmm. And we are absolutely dependent on our allies to deal with these pretty large security threats. Russia is constantly attacking us through its cyber capabilities. China is, I wouldn't say a national security threat per se, but it's a looming problem. And of course, we have North Korea that we're trying to negotiate with right now. It's actually a mm-hmm. little bit dumbfounding to listen to these justifications, especially as we're supposed to be coming together to deal with these big looming geopolitical threats. And instead, we're pushing our allies away and getting into some pretty fuzzy areas. And people are now saying the words trade war in hushed tones frequently.
You mentioned China. Let's turn toward that part mm-hmm. of the world. So, you know, just as G7 was escalating because of the tariffs on June 1st, we had the third round of negotiations with China for various economic and trade concessions. And that seemed to come out sort of at the end of the weekend with very little. So what does that look like from our perspective? We're fighting, it seems, you know, a trade conflict on mm-hmm. several fronts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when a lot of this steel, aluminum stuff was first coming up, it was put in the context of China over and over and over again. And something that many economists have pointed out is that we only import, 3% of our steel from China. So this is a really, really minimal amount. So we're actually hitting areas of trade that are not actually where we're having concerns with China in particular. So China, of course, has its own protectionist policies in place for its and undercuts on price, all of this stuff. But when it comes to our China objectives, we have a lot of other geostrategic objectives with this country, and you can't divorce trade from national security, which is what they want to do. So when you want to contain China, there's containing China in the South China Sea, but there's also collaborating with China when it comes to North Korea. Mm-hmm. And we want to divorce all of these issues, but they're not divorceable.
Yeah. So what does the China sort of economic picture look like? So Megan alluded to the fact that it doesn't seem like the economic argument for levying tariffs against China or using this as leverage actually makes sense. What are we doing to China right now? What are we holding over their heads? What are they holding over our heads?
Okay. So there's two separate things. So there's the 232 on steel mm-hmm. and aluminium, mm-hmm. where many would argue that the root cause of any pain in the American steel and aluminium industries is China. Then there's the Section 301, mm-hmm. which is the thing that they've been having talks over mm-hmm. recently. So that's a different trade law that isn't connected to national security. And basically, the law says that if another country has denied America benefits under some trade deal or broken some rules, then essentially the Americans can negotiate and then. If they can't find a reasonable solution to this problem, then they can hit back with tariffs. And there was some kind of security aspect to the report that they published as part mm-hmm. of that investigation. They, they mentioned cyber theft that they, mm-hmm. they accused the Chinese of doing. But yeah, so at the moment, we've got this looming threat. The Trump administration has said that it will publish a list of tariffs on June 15th. And that, tariffs will go into effect shortly after that if they can't negotiate some kind of deal. The Chinese have said, if you hit us, we'll hit you back. Mm-hmm. They've said that, if you hit us with tariffs, then we have to stop talks on trade. Mm-hmm. I think when these tensions first arose, there was some skepticism that the Trump administration would really go all the way, right? Given everything that's going on with North Korea, there was skepticism that they would completely bust up the trade relationship because it was so important that they kept the North Korea issue, on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
I think given everything we've seen, given the, you know, the conflicting agendas within the Trump administration, there are some people who just want to agree a quick deal and have all of this trade stuff go away. There are others who are much more hawkish and say, no, there are these really fundamental issues that are, you know, China's industrial policy. We really need them to have this wholesale change in their economic strategy before we'll agree anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's that second group that if they win, we could, you know, we could go all the way. We could get these tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the question is, you know, as you say, they've really been trying to keep these issues separate. They've been claiming that this is a trade issue and that, uh-huh. you know, that's the other stuff. But I'm not sure geopolitics works like that. If you are in a situation where you've got $50, $100, $150 billion worth of trade affected by tariffs,
mm-hmm.
I think it could make things pretty difficult if that were to go into force.
And you alluded to a sort of bifurcation in the party itself. What does that look like domestically for us? What are the opinions amongst the Republicans?
So trade is this really, really unique topic that's kind of flipped in history multiple times. So the founding of the Republic was partially a pushback against British mercantilism policies. And then we came in and we kind of became protectionists ourselves for a little bit. Republicans were pretty protectionist for a really long time. And then, of course, they continued being protectionist through some pretty terrible policies in the 1930s. And there was a split in the U.S. The North were fairly protectionist for their factories and such. And the South, for a while, with their cotton industry, was actually the more free traders because they needed to trade outwards. They needed to sell.
They had a huge, basically, exports. It was slavery gave them a huge competitive
yes.
advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that continued even after the Civil War. And so, but then it switched. Mm-hmm. The Republicans became the bigger advocates of free trade deals. And then, you know, post-Cold War got to be fairly open trade policies, even in the 90s, as you're seeing some pushback from the Ross Perot, Pat Buchanan characters, you're still generally getting this pro-trade
mm-hmm.
Movement. And then, of course, Trump came in, and the folks in Congress right now, even as they continue saying, the Republicans especially, even as they continue saying, what are you doing? We're the party of free trade. We don't like tariffs. We don't like protectionist policies. They're not actually pushing back. And even McConnell just today or last night maybe said something to the extent of, you know, this is the president's purview. The Congress doesn't need to do anything to step in. And hopefully we can just personally convince him to not launch a trade war.
Mm-hmm. And that was in response to a proposed amendment that would give Congress purview over any sort of national security-oriented tariffs, right?
Yes. Senator Corker wasn't saying don't negotiate, wasn't saying you can't impose tariffs. It was just saying that Congress, the Senate, should have a voice to veto if this isn't truly a legitimate tariff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. The Constitution puts trade policy in the hands of Congress, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so over time, there have been some exceptions granted where mm-hmm. Congress had handed authority to the executive mm-hmm. and said that, you know, in, you know, times of war, national emergency, the president should have more power. And
mm-hmm.
those powers were delegated pretty much on the assumption that Congress would always be more protectionist than the president.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you look at the other trade law that we have that isn't to do with national security, then there are fairly, you know, detailed criteria that have to be met before you're allowed to put on tariffs. We have anti-dumping laws, we have safeguarding mm-hmm. laws, great laws, if anyone wants to read up on them. It's been my life for the last year and a half. But this national security one is really unusual. It's not very often used. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's really striking how different it is to most trade law because the president has such huge discretion to do whatever he mm-hmm. wants. And also just how vague the criteria are for him imposing mm-hmm. These tariffs. So I think there was this recent, piece of legislation that some Republican senators have been pushing to essentially say we should be able to decide whether it's actually on national security grounds or not, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of in recognition that actually America has a lot of laws to protect its economic security, mm-hmm. right? There mm-hmm. are trade defense laws. You know, this law, it essentially allows the administration to set its own criteria for what counts as a national security threat. It then allows the administration to set whatever remedy it wants. It doesn't set a time limit on how long mm-hmm. these trade remedies have to be. Mm-hmm. And as we're seeing, it can be abused.
Mm-hmm. And what I found initially when 232 was coming out, obviously the first question on my mind was, okay, what are the remedies, right? What's the domestic remedy? And the statute itself doesn't provide any remedy for this type of action. Yeah. So we're left with an interesting lacuna in the law, an open question as to whether or not, I mean, I suspect an APA challenge against sort of the commerce action wouldn't work. The president isn't acting as an agency. So there's an open question. There will be litigation, but how it'll come out in the CIT is still sort of unknown.
So I think there has been one case. There was one company that tried to sue mm-hmm. The Trump administration for the restrictions on, yes. I think it was steel, but I think it was overturned. I think in this case, it's fairly difficult to challenge mm-hmm. The president's authority.
So, okay, I'm going to take a step back. From the conversation we've just had, all of this seems incredibly chaotic, right? We have a world power that has a law that allows the president to say, well, I sort of, you know, I think this might be right. I'm going to levy tariffs for national security reasons, but I don't actually have to have sort of clear or convincing justification for it. This is obviously my gloss on what's going on. And then a bunch of other countries are affected in different ways. And suddenly there's a spiral of negotiations and sort of tit for tat types of threats. But I thought that we had an institution for this, right? There's the World Trade Organization. So let's turn to that. What's going on at the WTO? Like, how is this going to interact with that?
Oh, my favorite topic. Yay. Okay, so, So according to the rules of the World Trade Organization that America helped to set up and was a driving force behind, you're not allowed to just randomly increase your tariffs because you want to like help out a certain industry like steel or aluminium. However,
it's like the premise of the protection.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, you're not allowed to just raise your tariffs above what you had previously committed. Second of all, you're not allowed to do it in a discriminatory way. So you're not allowed to, for example, put tariffs on some trading partners and quotas on others and then exempt Australia just for no reason. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the Australians think they have a reason. Okay. So you're not allowed to raise tariffs. You're not allowed to do it in a discriminatory way. However, there is an exception. So if a member of the World Trade Organization judges that they need to break their commitments because of something that they judge to be in their national security interests, then they're allowed. Okay, so the law is really interesting because essentially it's written in such a way to suggest that it is self-judging. It is for a country to decide for themselves whether there is a sufficient national security threat which allows them to break these rules. So clearly what's happened is that the Americans have put on these tariffs in the name of national security. I think the tally is either 5 or 6 other countries have now challenged America at the World Trade Organization. Okay, yeah. So 6 mm-hmm. have challenged America at the World Trade Organization. This morning, the latest one was Mexico. And they're saying, no, America, you're not, this isn't okay. This violates mm-hmm. the spirit of the rules. You're not actually... So first of all, you're breaking your commitments. And second of all, we think this is actually a different thing that you're doing. We think that you're doing a safeguard, which is, mm-hmm. You know, a broad economic protection, which the rules do allow. But mm-hmm. they say you're doing this in a way that isn't allowed.
Which under that argument allows them to retaliate immediately, correct?
Exactly, mm-hmm. yes. So you can, if you think that America was actually doing a safeguard, then the safeguard rules allow America to put up tariffs if imports have been surging into America. Mm-hmm. And you're allowed to retaliate immediately if some of your exports haven't actually been surging to America. And then after 3 years, you can retaliate to the whole amount. And that 3-year period is normally the incentive to stop mm-hmm. The original round of tariffs. Okay, so the other countries are saying, actually, you're doing a safeguard and also you're not allowed to violate your commitments under the World Trade Organization. And, this will go through the WTO's dispute process, but it looks obvious that the Americans will appeal to this exception, which allows them to put to do whatever they want, essentially, because it's in their national security interests. So this is just horrible for the judges at the World Trade Organization. If we get that far, if this actually gets to the point at which judges are ruling on this, they're basically in a lose-lose situation, right? Either they say, no, America, you think that it's in your national security interests, but we have judged that this is phony, in which case America is going to say, well, this is a violation of our sovereignty. Or they say, yeah, sorry, guys, America can do this, in which case it's a kind of free-for-all and the organization is sort of exposed for not being able to stop this kind of thing.
And so this hasn't come up at the WTO before. That's why the consequences are so troubling.
Yeah, there have been some cases where this thing has been invoked, but it's never been disputed and taken all the way to the WTO's kind of appellate body. There's also another massive twist to this whole story, which is that the Trump administration at the moment is refusing to appoint judges to the WTO's appellate body, right? And so basically here there's this whole separate argument about should you have binding dispute resolution, and there are people within the Trump administration who think that you should return to the pre-WTO situation where it was non-binding. So effectively in that circumstance, you know, you go into a negotiation and whoever's more powerful wins. And so there's this process whereby they're stopping the appointment of judges. And so, you know, it could be actually that this body becomes dysfunctional before the dispute even gets to the appellate body. And so, you know, if you're a trading partner of the US and you've been hit by these tariffs, you know, these six countries, they've been, you know, they're trying to respect the rules, they've launched their official dispute, but looking down the horizon, there's this question of whether that body will be effective in adjudicating this. It doesn't look like the Trump administration cares very much about what the WTO's appellate body thinks, in which case, you know, how useful do you really think that framework is going to be at curtailing his behavior, and do you want to take matters into your own hands? And that's where we get the real risk, right? At the point at which no one thinks the WTO is going to be effective, people start responding in tit for tat. It does become a game of power rather than a game of rules. And that's where it all gets really dangerous.
Yeah. And just to point out how serious this judge thing is, they're term limited. So the judges have to vacate their positions after their term is ended. And by the end of 2019, three more are going to be termed, and there will be one judge left, and you need three judges to rule on any case.
They'll be in court.
So this will literally prevent them from being a functioning body.
So there are several, it seems to me like there are several really unfortunate paths from the national security perspective. The first and the most simple, although I think that's an understatement, is if the WTO decides what it means for a country to invoke the GATT Article 21 exception, then the WTO is either saying we're ceding sovereignty to you, country, because we've decided that it is entirely self-judging and we don't have jurisdiction to decide whether you're right or not, or the WTO is saying we are taking your sovereignty in this respect and we're going to decide whether or not you're justified in your national security exception. And the WTO at that point will be positioning itself relative to the United States in the first instance as sort of an ineffective body, or relative to the rest of the world as an ineffective body. So it's sort of in a catch-22 in even the sort of, you know, more kind of rule of law oriented set of outcomes. And then in the non-rule of law oriented set of outcomes, the WTO itself could functionally dissolve, right? It seems like, which is, you know, in the first order, maybe not an explicit national security implication, but in the second order, you're just taking away an international organization meant to rationalize and sort of organize our trade relations, right? That's—
okay, so having been, you know, saying that the end of the world is nigh, I should
no, please dial me back. Maybe, I'm begging.
Maybe add some caveats. Maybe
I would love for that to sound less terrible.
Okay, so number one, it's possible that all of this gets resolved before it gets to the WTO appellate body ruling on it. Great, right? That's probably a best case scenario. So hopefully this all dies down. There is very little appetite from the rest of the world, from basically countries who are not America, for the WTO to stop functioning, right? And so I'm fairly sure that there are discussions going on between non-America members of the WTO to basically keep the institution going whatever America does. So, you know, we're not about to, you know, have the trade law apocalypse.
Well, can we just throw out there that the WTO has usually ruled fairly favorably for the US? This has been a body that tends to like what we do. We're not always in violation of...
the WTO... Generally, if you take out a case at the WTO, the people who take out cases tend to win those cases. Yeah. You know, the US has won a lot of very high profile cases. It has also lost some very high profile cases that it's annoyed about. I think it would be difficult to prove that the WTO is somehow biased against
America. Meaning to say.
There are some long running gripes that, you know, people in the US trade bar have with the way that it's made its decisions. Basically, the problem there is that it's been impossible to agree many new rules at the World Trade Organization because you need all members to agree on stuff. And so where you haven't been able to agree new rules, there have been ambiguities in the rules, and people in the US claim that the WTO has been interpreting law that doesn't exist and therefore kind of holding the US to commitments that it never made. So those are its kind of long-standing irritations, and it's probably a separate episode of Lawfare to work out whether it's justified.
The Lawfare trade team episode.
See you next time. but yeah, I mean, you really can't argue that the WTO has somehow been really terrible for America.
No.
So considering that I've somewhat situated myself as the voice of apocalyptic prophecy in this podcast, trade war. Right. We hear a lot of people saying the words trade war. Okay. Just tell me, are we in one? Are we in a trade war? What does a trade war look like? What does that mean?
No.
Yeah. I don't think we're there yet. Weaponizing trade, though, is how you get there.
Yeah. So for me, I think we're in a trade war at the point at which we've got tit for tat escalation of tariffs. Mm-hmm. Right. So in the next few weeks, months, more countries will start imposing the retaliation that they've threatened in response to these tariffs on steel and aluminium. Mm-hmm. The question is how the Trump administration responds to that. Mm-hmm. There have been investigations into whether cars and car parts imports are a threat to America's national security. Mm-hmm. Good luck to the bureaucrat who's having to write that report. If we see that, then, you know, that's an order of magnitude bigger than the steel and aluminium case. That's more than $350 billion worth of imports in 2017. That's really, really big. Mm-hmm. so, you know, when that sort of thing, when that escalation starts happening, sure, we're in trade war territory. For now, I think we're not there yet.
Yeah. Right now you're seeing responses, but they're super targeted. They are on, you know, motorcycles from Wisconsin and alcohol from Kentucky. We are hitting Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell where it hurts the most.
Mm-hmm. But more importantly, the scale of the retaliation seems to be in proportion to the amount of trade that was affected the first time around, right? So all these countries have notified to the World Trade Organization, this is how much we're being affected and this is how much we will hit back. You know, there's all the documentation. Canada and Mexico have slightly different notification requirements, but fine. Mm-hmm. So they're all trying to seem as though they're playing by the rules, right? So, you know, when we're truly in the rules of the jungle, maybe some of those notifications will stop happening.
Yeah. But good luck convincing folks in Wisconsin and Kentucky that things aren't that bad yet.
So you mentioned that Canada and Mexico have different reporting requirements. One of the things that we haven't spoken about at all is NAFTA today. So to the extent that NAFTA is sort of caught up in all of this trade mess, what do the next steps look like? Canada, as Megan mentioned earlier, Canada has been responding fairly aggressively to the June 1st tariff. So where are we with NAFTA?
Oh, NAFTA. Okay, so for now, it looks like the talks are not progressing at the same speed that they were before these tariffs went into place. So Justin Trudeau, when these tariffs were implemented, came out and said, you know, we offered to wrap this whole thing up with the Trump administration, but they said that in order to do so, we would have to accept a sunset clause. on the NAFTA, which would basically mean that it would expire every so often. Now, there's no point in having a trade deal if it expires every so often, because the point of a trade deal is that you're meant to have certainty, and expiry dates don't equal certainty. Right. So this was a red line for the Canadians. They said no, and then we got the tariffs. So, you know, the Trump administration clearly thinks that these tariffs are some way of extracting concessions from the Mexicans and the Canadians, as well as a national security thing. You know, it's mm-hmm. all kind of tangled up. Mm-hmm. And it's possible that there's some very, very long game being played, in that, you know, there's a very, very small chance that in the next few weeks, the Mexicans and the Canadians will say, sure, we agree to the new NAFTA, and great, you know, these tariffs have been lifted. Mm-hmm. I'm skeptical that that's how the politics is going mm-hmm. to play out. I think it's very, very complicated mm-hmm. to agree a NAFTA while it looks like Mexico and Canada have guns pointed to their heads, effectively. And also, you know, just generally, you might think that the point of NAFTA basically was to give America's trading partners, Mexico and Canada, security that they would not be hit by these random tariffs, mm-hmm. right? So by imposing these tariffs, the Trump administration is signaling to Mexico and Canada, oh, you thought we had this trade deal, but oh, actually, we can hit you with tariffs if we want, right? So the value of this deal has actually been damaged by the Trump administration's mm-hmm. decision to just include everyone.
And the auto imports investigation that you mentioned, the sort of proposed research about auto imports being a danger to national security, will also affect NAFTA, right?
Yeah, and you can kind of game out different ways in which the Trump administration might be playing this. Mm-hmm. I think at the point at which we've got a report from the Trump administration saying that car imports and car parts imports are a threat to national security, and we have the prospect of tariffs on those things, I think this is like a whole extra level sure. of scary, that it's difficult to think about how that could play into some kind of NAFTA negotiations. I think at the point at yeah. which the Trump administration is seriously trying to impose those as leverage, mm-hmm. I just can't see how they could have talks in good faith.
It's a free-for-all at that point. So, well, just throwing out there, too, this how the Trump administration is approaching this actually goes along with his rhetoric from the campaign and even before. For instance, when he discussed NATO, for instance, in the campaign, he rarely talked about NATO for its actual national security implications. He talked about NATO as an organization that wasn't paying its fair share to the U.S. And this is how he talks about even the national security tariffs that he's trying to put in, or national security restrictions that he's trying to put in place, is it's as if other countries aren't paying their fair share, because he seems to think of trade as a zero-sum game.
So we've talked about a lot of different things, and I think that we should make an effort to sort of wrap it up and synthesize what the important points are. What should national security interested readers and listeners be paying attention to from here on out? You guys can volunteer sort of the tops of your lists.
The one thing I want listeners to look out for going forward, the national security concern folks especially, is how our allies are going to be responding to this, and whether or not they're bringing this up in all of those discussions on our other bigger geostrategic threats. The question I have is whether the administration is going to respond to those statements, those comments, those pushes that everyone is expecting are coming from our allies in Europe, from Canada, from Mexico, mm-hmm. countries that we depend on to meet our national security goals.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what comes out of not only sort of the long-term conversations, but the very short-term ones, right? The G7 leadership conference is coming up this weekend, and we have no idea what statements are going to come out and what tone they're going to have.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I would tell people to watch out for is, you know, we've seen the Trump administration tie together national security as a device to give it more control over its trade mm-hmm. policy. First, in terms of steel and aluminium, if it does that again on cars and car parts, then mm-hmm. then, you know, be worried.
Yeah,
and certainly, as we mentioned earlier, I think keeping an eye on the stability and integrity of the WTO is also important, and how various countries, not the U.S., are negotiating, sort of maintaining the system that we set up in the 90s.
Yeah, and despite Mitch McConnell's faith that the administration would come around, the body that we actually may have to depend on to deal with this is Congress.
And with that, I want to thank you both so much for joining me, Dr. Megan Rees and Sumaiya Keynes. Thank you so much. This was a lovely conversation, and my outlook is now more positive than it was before. That's not true.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you're craving more wonky trade content, listen to Trade Talks with Sumaiya Keynes and Chad Bown, available wherever you listen to podcasts. If you haven't yet, take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a rating and review. Do not levy unwarranted tariffs against us. Our audio editor is Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.